This is Dylan FM, the podcast that goes deep into the work and world of Bob Dylan. You're listening to an extended episode, available exclusively to FM Plus or premium subscribers, with your host, Craig Danieloff.
If you're a longtime Bob Dylan fan, chances are good you know Michael Gray and have read or studied closely one or more of his incredible books. We were lucky to talk to Michael last season about Time Out of Mind, and he's back today to share his very interesting thoughts and observations about the songs on Good As I've Been to You. Today, we're going to hear his thoughts in what I hope you find an interesting way. I'm going to read brief passages from Song and Dance Man about this album, and specifically the songs and performances on the record, and then Michael is going to expand or elaborate on the comments he made in the book. It's a kind of book club with the author approach that lets everyone who isn't yet familiar or read it many years ago hear the beautiful and insightful thoughts in the book. And then he adds more color, updated thoughts, and talks about these songs since it's been over 20 years since he wrote those passages. And I'm able to ask follow-up questions. There's a reason why Song and Dance Man gets fawning reviews from other authors, experts, musicians, and others. And there's a reason why the Bob Dylan Center announced today that they've invited Michael to be the featured speaker for their upcoming first anniversary. I think you'll get a sense of these reasons listening to this show. We're in the midst of a deep dive on Good As I've Been to You and World Gone Wrong, and if you've been reading our Substack, you know we've recently shared a playlist of newer covers of these songs. And we've promised another playlist of source versions very soon. In fact, next week on this podcast, we'll take a tour of all kinds of great Good As I've Been to You cover versions by people other than Bob Dylan with our friend Ray Padgett. The covers are one way to get new perspectives on these songs. And I think you'll find that our conversation with Michael Gray today is another, one that hopefully sends you back to listen to Good As I've Been to You again. Now, let's listen to our conversation with Michael Gray about Good As I've Been to You. All the quotes you'll hear read in this episode are from Song and Dance Man 3, The Art of Bob Dylan. You start the chapter by talking about how in '88, Bob had started putting old songs back into his set. You saw a New York show, and you mentioned that as a nice intro to what he chose to do in '92.
All right. Okay.
Yeah, so do you want to talk a little bit about those acoustic performances at that time and kind of where Bob was and what you thought it meant, or just the reaction you had to hearing him go back and do, you know, Man of Constant Sorrow, Eileen Aroon, Two Soldiers, Trail of the Buffalo, Lakes of Pontchartrain, Wagoneer's Lad, Barbara Allen, Pretty Peggio, One Song a Night for almost all of '88. There was none in '87. I looked back, it really wasn't there.
Absolutely. Well, you know, in '87, he was struggling, wasn't he? And there's all that kind of mystical, I'd like to say, nonsense in Chronicles about how this kind of triangular thing that he stumbled upon meant that he could play his songs again. I mean, the '87 tour, I saw it in Europe, and Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers did their best, but you know, and there were a few lovely Bob solo performances that were lovely by Bob, but on the whole, he was struggling, and someone I know said, "One more time, if he's like this, I'm going to give up." Well, you know, so what? But people weren't saying that in '88. I saw him at, I came to New York for the Radio City Music Hall gigs, which of course were not the opening gigs of the never-ending tour, but they were better live than they are when you listen to recording. But that's, I think that's the case with more or less everything he's ever done live except the 66. And the 66 are better to listen to now because they're so much clearer you know, the electric stuff, I mean. But anyway, as for 88, yeah, he did. It was striking that he was leaning on G.E. Smith somewhat for the guitar work. You know, he was out front and acoustic, but as far as I remember, never actually totally solo. I might be wrong there, in which case, please cut that out. But certainly it was striking that he wanted to do those things. And some of them, of course, were songs he had done very, very early on in his career. But some weren't. Eileen Aroon, I mean, that was a real highlight for me. Not especially if he did it at Radio City Music Hall in New York, but there are a couple of truly outstanding, beautiful performances of that marvelous song. And when he's really concentrating on a song like that, there's nothing like it. He's marvelous. It's as good as hearing Visions of Johanna solo. You know, it was thrilling. But also, of course, what was thrilling in 88 live was the was what a kind of punk, stripped down rock sound he had when he was doing the rest of the set. But certainly, you know, he was showing a lot of interest in those old songs. Obviously, some of them he'd picked up from Pacific People, Lakes of Pontchartrain, from Paul Brady, Paul Brady. Yeah. And Little Moses, I think, from the Carter family. I might be wrong. And then when the albums came out that were these solo acoustic performances of songs that he didn't write any of, what a marvelous thing to do in the face of some kind of apparent difficulty with either writing or performing live. But of course, you know, 87, yes, he does that. And then he switches to the stripped down rock sound for 88. But you know, we also get Oh Mercy.
I think it's 87, but it is interesting to think about the way we think about Oh Mercy and the way we think about those 88, 89 tours, whatever it is, right after, right around that.
Yeah.
They're different. And they're
different. Yeah. There is such a difference between the Oh Mercy album, Bob Dylan, and the 88, 89 Bob Dylan. Yeah.
Yeah. I was at one of the shows you actually cite in your footnote on that, the same page, or when you're talking about this, which is the Denver show. I think you cited an Eileen Aroon tape from there. And yeah, that was, right. I was at that fifth show of the Neverending Tour. And it was the transformative show for me. I mean, I'd been a somewhat casual Dylan fan, and that show was just religious.
Right. And then in 89, I came over again for the Beacon show with my wife and our daughter, who had been born in August 88. And so in the autumn of 89, she was very young indeed. She would sleep on a bench in a restaurant where we were. We found some very interesting restaurants in New York in 89, kind of weird fusions like Indian Spanish. One of them was, for example. Our daughter slept through six Bob Dylan concerts at the Beacon. At the Beacon one night, I had to collect a pair of tickets for the show from Jeff Rosen. And I was going to meet him at the backstage door. I was there with my wife and daughter. And then we were standing at the stage door, and Tony Garnier came out of the stage door and saw my daughter in my wife's arm and said, they even bring their babies for him to bless.
The other comment you make that I thought was interesting in terms of place setting early in this chapter is you relate Good As I've Been to You to the original Bob Dylan album.
The original Bob Dylan album had two songs that Bob had written, although they were, you know, they were very heavily Guthrie-ized sort of songs. And there's nothing equivalent to that on Good As I've Been to You and World Gone Wrong. The similarities are considerable, aren't they? I mean, it's the first time he's done solo album since 1964. And that last solo album in the 60s was Another Side of Bob Dylan, which was very much his own song and a very radical departure from the early work. But the first album is a mixture of old blues by people like Henry Thomas and old white material. That just seemed like the closest thing he was returning to. I mean, I'm not sure that he gave a damn about that one way or another, you know. It may never have crossed his mind that there was any particular comparison, and I wouldn't want to push it too far. I think what both albums have in common, the first album and then the Good As I've Been to You, for example, they're both dredging things up in Dylan's mind from the hugely important Harry Smith anthology of American folk music, which you know, had come out in the early 50s. And which everyone in Greenwich Village knew more or less by heart, and had been the first time on any compilation album white musicians and black musicians had been put together on the same album. And so, you know, there's a parallel there that Bob is reaching back in to a kind of tradition that Harry Smith initiated.
Well, let's dig into some of the songs. I'm going to start with, as he does, with Frankie and Albert, which, and I'll say here that what's amazing about the Song and Dance Man book in this chapter is the lineages you trace on earlier versions, alt versions. You know, I know it's hard to know what Bob heard, what he didn't heard. Sometimes these songs, at this time, songs were evolving. You know, in this one particularly, there's five titles. The lyrics changed more dramatically than most of the other songs. But you did the detective work, and as you've pointed out, in the pre-internet era. And so anyone who really wants to understand this stuff should certainly seek out the book. But here's what you said about Frankie and Albert.
Dylan here exhibits his usual haughty disregard for the prevailing winds. If you were to get up at a folk club anywhere in the Western world and start singing Frankie and Albert or Frankie and Johnny, you'd be sneered right out of the place. It's too well known, too obvious. Dylan's album makes it the opening track.
Yeah, it's so typical of him, isn't it? That's just true. I mean, I just completely agree with what I wrote. Not that I know much about what goes on in folk clubs, but you know, you wouldn't get up and do that now. You just wouldn't. Maybe people do, but it's not what he would have chosen to do when he got up in folk clubs in 1961 and 2.
Yeah, and then a few paragraphs later, you kind of go further into Bob's, Bobness in choice.
There is an immense multiplicity here, and reopening these gates is, for someone in Bob Dylan's position, a far greater acting against the grain than could possibly be achieved with a rock album. Good As I've Been to You and World Gone Wrong turn a radio telescope upon the past, retrieving that which seems light years away in the era of Microsoft, McDonald's, and MTV. These albums are anthropologies of individualism, but they also champion the dignity of labor, the silenced and oppressed. They celebrate oral history, working class history, history that struggled against oceans.
You find a deeper story there than someone who might just listen to the album and go, oh, Bob's doing these cute old songs.
Yeah, I think it's very striking. You know, he starts out challenging the folk world at the beginning of his career, and then he becomes this very radical artist. I mean, you know, doing extraordinary work in the 60s. And then here he is in the 90s. He has become a conservative figure. I mean, you know, he conserves, conservative in a good sense. He conserves things. And he's very interested in the past. And, you know, he's always, for someone who is this middle-class guy from Minnesota, he's always had a very blue-collar consciousness about stuff. It's there in Working Man's Blues number 2. It's there in all kinds of stuff. But here, yeah, he's singing songs that celebrate people who did not sit down with a pen and paper and write songs. And in some cases, people who never sat down and wrote at all, perhaps didn't even know how to read. It's a marvelous archaeological dig into an America that he values far more than the one he fulminates against in, for example, the Biograph interview. So
then a few paragraphs later, you write a sentence that could have been written in the last 5 years. Yet Dylan's concern here is not looking back at himself and his own past, but shepherding us out into an older and wiser world. So if we look at, you know, the philosophy of modern song and many of his more recent activities, that sentence summarizes.
Yes, philosophy of modern song bugs me. The albums don't.
But even in the Sinatra period, we could say the same thing was true.
Oh, yeah, but, you know, I hate that argument, actually, because the thing about the Sinatra songs, yes, he's excavating a past, but what past is it? It's a past of very slick, professional songwriters, mostly in pairs, these guys in New York sitting, you know, writing songs like, hey, I've got a great title, The Night We Called It a Day, Full Moon and Empty Arm. I mean, come on. There's nothing real about that material. It's like all that sort of, it's 3 o'clock in the morning and I've had one too many beers and, you know, I should have gone home, but I'm really a sophisticated kind of a guy. You know, I go to 1950s dinner dances, and I stand on the stair. I like jazz, you know, and I go like this when the music's cool, and you know, all that. That is not the same as real songs that have emerged out of real people, out of real people's lives. A lone guitar and a point of view. Dylan said about Cliff Carlisle. And, you know, it applies to all those pre-war blues singers who came along after the more show-busy people like Bessie Smith, who did have songwriters. All those people like Blind Lemon Jefferson, they come along with a lone guitar and a point of view, and they express something for the community in which they function. They are not slick professional songwriters in New York who probably look down on a great deal of the material that they offer to people of a lesser level, perhaps, than Ella Fitzgerald and Frank.
Yes, I'm not comparing the songs. I agree. All I'm saying is for Bob at 80, 75 to 80,
to be looking back at an era and having exposing people, a lot of people, for what it's worth in the larger context to that aesthetic, those songs, getting them to listen to a different thing, and of all the things he could do. And you know, we can go longer on the philosophy of modern song another time, but I do think it lets people learn about, hear about, think about things that the bulk of people living today who aren't that far from the phone, you know, screen of their phone. He's looking away from himself and he's trying to show people things. So,
yeah, but I would say, you know, where he says, well, I'm not covering this material, I'm uncovering. And I think, when did it ever go away? I mean, why did Bob Dylan need to uncover it? It's never gone away. Whereas without Bob Dylan, who ever heard Love Henry?
I agree. And my favorite thing about, I've always loved the albums, but going in and I've been listening to tons of the other versions, those that predate Bob and those that, you know, it was shocking to me. There's, you know, 5 to 50 versions of each of these in the last 20 years. You know, I don't think Bob had a role in it. These were mostly songs that, you know, had a lot of cover. Bob put them, as you say, gave them exposure at a level that they might not have had to certain people who would not have heard them. This is about Jim Jones. This is one of those ones that almost all of the covers, they don't stray. They're mostly very consistent.
Yet how intensely well Dylan performs Jim Jones, despite, not because of, the broke down engine of his voice. The way he sings New South Wales is as disarmingly particular, as yearningly expressive of the romantic place names as he has ever been when he's been paying attention. He sings New South Wales more understatedly, but as beautifully, as in Boots of Spanish Leather, he sings Barcelona. Anyone who knows the studio version of the latter from the early 1960s will know that this is high praise indeed. His purpose this time, however, is not to stress romance, but to turn that level of poignancy to different effect.
Yeah. And by the way, on Boots of Spanish Leather, where the way he sings Barcelona, he has never once repeated that beautiful phrasing live. Not once. It's never been half as good as that original studio version. I like the fact that he keeps trying it, but, you know, he has many, many times. But anyway, New South Wales, yes. There's just, it's something completely unique to him, to his power as someone who can phrase things so that there's all the intensity and at the same time all the delicacy that you could possibly pack into a place name. I mean, it's easy to just sound wistful. Lots of singers try and do that. But Dylan is, he's so attentive about it, you know. The broken down voice, yes, but my God, the attention with which he still makes those noises with his mouth, you know. I mean, it's like those 66 live acoustic stuff where, you know, you listen to it now and you think there was a point back in 1966 where this young man was standing at a microphone on a stage and actually producing that moment by moment. And it's so immaculate. It's so utterly perfect, every breath and every pause. And part of that is a kind of calm center of self that he has. There's, you know, I think he's often lost it in a rockier kind of, but he has it when he's by himself. Every pause and every breath and every vocal sound it's all completely under the control of someone who feels absolutely some kind of calm center of self, no need to rush, no need to exaggerate. It's and in a way, it's a sort of trusting of the listener. You know, it would be easy to just not particularly notice how he sings New South Wales in Jim Jones. But once you do notice, you can appreciate that it's special in a way that no one else but Bob Dylan can ever bring up.
On Kennedy.io, a song I like, and our friend John Wesley Harding recorded this as well, I found. Here's what you say. Bob Dylan crashes into the song, making the guitar figure warmly enfolding, yet impatient, nervy, nettlesome, as befits the narrative of a dangerous sea voyage in exile, a voyage among murderous, scurvy rascals, but ending in success. Dylan's guitar puts you right there among the ropes and sails and creaking decks, while his vocal walks a perilous gangplank between melodrama and real feeling. Like the story's bold captain, he might prove true. While physically his voice falls down painfully, even grotesquely, once or twice, but always gets up and recovers itself and comes back warm and vivid.
Yeah, that's nice.
It's one of the pleasant songs on, I mean, there many of them are pleasant, but that one I think particularly, especially listening to lots of versions, it's just a there's a 10,000 Maniac version that's great.
Uh-huh.
You point out something else that I hadn't known, and I think I dug this up next. I'm going on to Sitting on Top of the World, that Bob Dylan has recorded it before at the other end of his career on harmonica and backing vocals for Big Joe Williams in New York City.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many things I maybe heard 20 years ago of old stuff that dig up, but going back and hearing him, his voice distinctively coming through, because some of the, you know, like the Carolyn Hector thing, who can tell who's on the harmonica with Harry Belafonte, but you can really hear Bob singing.
But now she gone, I ain't gonna worry, because I'm sitting on top of the world. Play, boy. Happy today, they know your name. Should I worry?
Absolutely. Big Joe Williams is very generous to Dylan. You know, he lets him do the harmonica, but he also lets him sing with him on the chorus line. And then a couple of times, he stands back from the microphone. And so the only voice you hear is Bob. And I've said this in talks I've given that, you know, there are these two guys with their different agendas. There is Big Joe Williams, elderly, you know, well, middle-aged, elderly by old blues singers, old working-class blacks standards. And, you know, he's trying to sound as virile and on the ball as possible. And there is the very young Bob Dylan trying to sound as old as the hill. But it's a great recording. I mean, I do think Sitting on Top of the World is the least successful recording on Good As I've Been to You. It just doesn't seem to be comfortable with the rhythmic groove of it.
Yeah, and you point out, which is interesting, because you point out the version that maybe inspired him, but the Mississippi Chic cadence that he adopted. Here's what you said.
I listened to the Mississippi Chic's version. Dylan replicates it at the same pace and word for careful word. Everyone has sung this song and everyone has personalized it. The lyric variations are boundless, and Dylan stands aside from all that and reproduces the Mississippi Chic's version from early 1930. It's too scrupulous. It's too carefully exact.
That's why it sounds so oddly rigid. It's a failure compounded by the way that Dylan adds harmonica accompaniment, and the harp suffers from the same tentativeness that has been its main fatal characteristic for so long now. He offers no equivalent to the bluegrass flavor that makes the Sheik's version attractive.
It's very unusual in Dylan to sound rigid. Very unusual, but yeah, he just sounds uncomfortable here. I don't know why he particularly follows that version, but certainly he does. There's a lovely version by Howling Wolf, which he would have done better to pay more attention to.
But then we have Hard Times, which you say is a near masterpiece.
Oh, yes.
And this is what you say about that.
It would be easy to find in all of this only the unacceptable face of its of-the-time sentimentality. But just as Dylan maximizes the vividness of that all around my cabin door in the refrain, because he's more interested in being alert to its imaginative pull than to its shortcomings as eternal truth poetics, so too in the verses, Dylan brings out marvelously the song's lurid Dickensian darkness. How he lingers in fretful fascination, far more on the word linger, over the mad ghostly line, "There are frail forms fainting at the door," singing the nebulous Victorian Gothic word forms as if test pushing against it, as if endeavoring to, by sheer concentration of will, to make it materialize into something more human, less supernatural. And it is the most human of touches that he brings, in a moment of lovely articulation, to the pale maiden's sighing all the day, enacting the sigh not only on the word sigh itself, but right across the four syllables he makes of all in that phrase. With its majestic incantatory length and the marvelous voice Dylan gives us, concentration and sustain throughout, this is one of the finest performances on the two albums.
Yes, I think it is. And I think, he quite likes cabin doors, doesn't he? He's had a cabin. He's built himself a cabin in Utah in an earlier lifetime. And the man in me also has something about, stuff raging outside my door. And here we have, here we have this weird, supernatural kind of, gothic Victoriana. It's about the only song by Stephen Foster that you can get away with singing now. Because of the outrageous political incorrectness of more or less every other song by Stephen Foster. But, melodically, they're marvelous. And this one is, I'm so pleased that Dylan did this, here is a case of uncovering something. Here is a case of a songwriter who somehow gets so much deeper into the human psyche than any of those Cole Porter, Gershwin people ever did. And Dylan really, he really gives this the treatment it deserves. And I'm just so pleased that he did it.
Was that one of the songs he did with Willie live on Big 6-0? I think there's a live, if I'm not mistaken, there's a live video performance of this a bit later, but nice as well.
Yeah, there might be, yeah.
Let us pause life's pleasures and count its many tears while we are of sorrow with the poor. There's a song that will linger forever in our ears. Hard times come again no more.
is a song, the sigh of the wind.
In fact, I think there's a couple of 1993 concerts where he opened with Hard Time in Europe. I might be wrong. I can't remember off the top of my head, but certainly I've heard a couple of those live versions where he's not with Willie Nelson, but just in his own concert. Yeah, he obviously really likes the song. The thing about Stephen Foster, of course, is that, you know, he was a northerner. He wrote all these sentimental, outrageous songs about, you know, darkies in the South. And he never in his life visited the South.
And then we have a very different song. I think one of the lightest, at least audibly, Step It Up and Go. Again, there's a very fun, this one, there's the musical diversity in the covers is all over the map. There's kind of, you know, jazz versions and all kinds of things. And here's what you say about Step It Up and Go.
Dylan's version is unambitious, as befits someone who understands the tradition in which the song sits. Conscious that a bravura performance is for the young and brash, and that there's 100 voices capable of matching up to what is a simple dance number, Bob Dylan settles quite rightly for something egolessly unexceptional. This is intelligent good time, on which his robust and clumsy guitar work is countered by an alert, true-to-the-genre vocal. As John Wesley Harding notes, he screws up the riff at the end, so he goes through the whole sequence again, just for the hell of it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. You know, it's, in a way, it's a rather tiresome song, you know. It's not the one that anyone would rush to the album to play. It's not the one that anyone would choose to try and convert someone to Bob Dylan with. It's a fairly mediocre song, really. But you know, it stands in that tradition. There's all these people who've done it, and I think I agree with what I said about him being deliberately modest about doing it. I think he knows that, you know, it's not the one to take to show off with.
And I should point out that your reference to John Wesley Harding is because elsewhere in the book you quote a review of Good As I've Been to You that Wesley Stace, then forming and writing as John Wesley Harding, wrote in 1992 or 3, which we just republished a few weeks ago on our blog and Substack with Wes's permission. So that was the source of that reference.
Yes, and actually when I saw it on that Substack thing, I had no recollection of having ever read it before. And I sent a message to Wes saying, well, this is terribly good stuff. I don't think I've ever seen it before. And he wrote back and said, you quoted it in your book. Yeah.
Yeah, I found it because of you in your book and then asked Wes permission. So it's a circle.
Right. Well, then I think to go back to something we were mentioning earlier, I think he does a very effective linking of this album with the first Bob Dylan album.
All right. So now a song that for most people, maybe the only song on this album that they would have heard before Good As I've Been to You. I mean, people like me at least, which is Tomorrow Night, where the Elvis Presley version and some others are pretty wide circulation. But again, there are many, many versions and many great versions. But we're publishing, I published one playlist already. Ray Padgett and I are about to do, we've got more than 100 versions of all these songs, and we're about to do a little review of the originals and our favorites, and there'll be another podcast and more set list about that. So people who want to listen to these songs from many angles will have the chance. But about Dylan's version of Tomorrow Night,
you said, Dylan's version is not perhaps for the uninitiated, but it's a lovely thing. A performance that puts us right inside the poor white trash radio romance world of Hank Williams, Elvis's boyhood, and long-lost working-class America. The value of such a performance is that Dylan avoids Rykooterish cleverness and the self-consciousness of dry curation here. His impassioned partisan understanding of the genre fleshes out its recreation on Bones of Love, allowing him to take the song seriously, as Elvis does. He's therefore free to sing the earthly, falling line of mistrust and future gloom, "Will all the thrill be gone," so that it carries open, beguiling warmth. It's a reading with more than a hint of Dylan's interpretive genius.
Yeah, I love the falling way he sings that line. But certainly not for the uninitiated. A relative of mine heard it and said, he really can't sing, can he?
Not the first time for that observation.
Right.
All right, and we get to the penultimate Diamond Joe. This one, here's your thoughts on the Good As I've Been to You version.
Dylan sings the song immaculately, while playing a quietly dexterous guitar part and achieving a flowing cohesion between the two. By no means an immediate highlight of the album, it grows into one. It looks you in the eye and addresses you directly without mannerism or flash, although there's a great deal of quiet artfulness in the presentation. There's the lovely delicacy of the way that on the phrase, "Nearly starved to death, boys," voice and guitar slide down the scale together, as if with a solicitous politeness. And though Bob Dylan on form is famously good at never singing a repeat line the same way twice, the various ways he finds here to breathe that closing Joe at the end of each of the song's four verses is, even by his own standards, a delight. This is not a track on which you will hear painful vocal difficulty. There is no striving to do it, no apparent effort, and no sense of artifice. He varies the way he sings that small word with the most unobtrusive kind of aplomb, so that it comes across as thoughtful and as expressively rueful looking back.
Yeah, I think it. I think he really does something magical with that song. It could be a real, you know, oh, we're so poor. We've had such hard working lives. Woe is me. And he doesn't, he raises it somewhere else. No one but Bob Dylan could sing Joe four different ways. No one could. I mean, it's just one of the fundamental things that he brought to singing. That nobody paid attention to before. It was all to do, you know, before Bob Dylan, it was all to do with hitting the note, you know, as if that was enough. I mean, classical pianists don't think just hitting the notes is enough. You have to do something special with it. And no one has ever done so much, so special as Dylan.
Beautiful. All right, well, let's wrap up with this. So this is near the middle of the chapter, because the chapter goes on to cover World Gone Wrong equally well. But you say,
in writing about Belle Isle, I once suggested that Dylan's taste for narrative ballads was for those tales that were of horses and daughters and hangings, exile and injustice. The songs on Good As I've Been to You fit this pattern pretty well. In the end, what is so clear from this collection is not merely that it has the thematic unity of a concept album without any of the potential self-importance, but that while Bob Dylan hasn't written a single one of these songs, the album could hardly be more Dylan-esque.
Yeah, absolutely spot on. Well, it's true, isn't it? It could hardly be more Dylan-esque. And with World Gone Wrong as well, you know, where the change he makes to the title song, you know, the Mississippi Shakes, it's the world is going wrong. Well, you know, you can't come along in the 1990s and say, hey, you know, I think the world's going wrong. So by Dylan updates it by putting it in the past. He makes, instead of going wrong, it's already gone wrong, which is quite clearly the more truthful, on the ball thing to be noticing. And it, of course, it makes that change, that little change he makes for a perfect Dylan-esque opening line to the album. Strange things have happened like never before. I mean, that's just a Dylan-esque line, isn't it?
Well, you're setting up a future chapter. A future chapter. Well, I guess I'll end with asking you, right, these two albums, But Good As I've Been to You starts it, are the common narrative is this is Bob consciously going, you know, back to ground to find himself, and, you know, flowers later bloom. How conscious do you think it was, or where does this all sit in the narrative as you see it? I mean, we've talked about where you thought he was in the late 80s and so forth, but summing up this album from the point of view of 32 years later, 31 years later, what does it do and what did it do for Bob?
I think it was a beautiful thing to do solo acoustic albums after all that time. And so that in itself is, you know, it's a very striking thing to do in the 1990s, to make the first solo album you've done since 1964. It also gave him a way of exploring his older voice without Daniel Lanois, among other things. I can't really go along with this kind of idea that he needed to go back to that in order to know how to write a song again, and therefore to give us the wonderment of Time Out of Mind. Because, you know, I'm one of the people who doesn't think Time Out of Mind is quite as great as everyone seems to have been spending the last couple of years saying. I don't see how the two connect. I think, you know, I don't like to speculate about what goes on in Bob Dylan's head. It would be ridiculous. I mean, I have occasionally fallen into the trap of doing that. You know, when I wrote about Street Legal as kind of leading to Slow Train, I get a bit dangerously biographical in my assumptions about him there. And on the whole, my attempt has been to do the opposite. You know, as I say at the very beginning of the book, he says, I think of myself as just a song and dance man. And I juxtapose that with D.H. Lawrence in 1924, saying, never trust the artist, trust the tale. In other words, you know, concentrate on the work, you know. The work is there whether we know anything about Bob Dylan, a person, or not. You know, it's like... It's like Shakespeare, you know. You have to tackle the work and stop worrying about, you know, whether it was him who wrote this or blah de blah, because there's so little biographical information, and God knows there's more than enough biography available on Bob Dylan. And in the end, what matters is not the man, however charismatic and beautiful he may sometimes be. In the end, the thing that matters is the work, the art of Bob Dylan.
Yes, well, thank you, Michael Gray, for helping us all see and understand that much better. This was a a great sampling of how you've done that. Thanks for talking to me today.
Okay.
Thanks for listening. This show is a part of the FM Podcast Network. visit us at fmpods.com.